to the headlines this hour. Ukraine's military says it is evacuating all remaining troops from the last stronghold of Mariupol, ceding control of the city to Russia. The EU foreign ministers failed to reach an agreement on a proposed oil embargo against Russia over the war in Ukraine. And a study shows more than half of Britons have seen their health deteriorate as a result of the cost of living crisis. Hello, welcome to This Is News. Thanks for joining us. The Ukraine's military says it is working to evacuate all remaining troops from the southern port city of Mariupol, ceding full control to Russia after weeks of a siege. The military has also announced an end to the combat mission in the city. On Monday, hundreds of Ukrainian forces, many of them wounded, were transferred to Russian-held towns. Moscow earlier said that a deal had been reached to evacuate the injured troops. Some 600 soldiers and civilians were holed up in Mariupol's Azovstal steel plant for over 2 months, as Russian forces took control of other parts of the city. Ukraine's deputy defense minister says that all of the evacuees will be subject to potential prisoner exchange with Moscow. Meanwhile, Russia continues its airstrikes on Kyiv and Lviv near Poland's border. A series of blasts have hit Lviv a few hours ago, but so far, no reports of casualties or damage. While the conflict in Ukraine continues, correspondent Johnny Miller has traveled to the Petrovsky district near the front line in Donetsk to investigate reports on the shelling of Donbas civilians by the Ukrainian army.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. Two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbas separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby, and it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
Зачем нас обстреливать?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery.
While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
EU foreign ministers have failed to reach an agreement on a sixth round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine. The latest tranche includes a proposal to ban imports of Russian oil to the EU, but Hungary is blocking the move over economic concerns. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, the Council of the EU, Brussels.
The surge in the cost of living in the UK is taking a heavy toll on the health of Britons. According to a YouGov poll, 55% of Britons say that their health has worsened due to such factors as heating and food costs. One in four cited assessments by medical professionals, adding that stress was a contributing factor to their ill health. According to the Royal College of Physicians, this should sound the alarm, especially as the inflation crisis has barely begun. Retailers have been warning that food price inflation could hit 10% in Britain this year. That is partially driven by the war in Ukraine and the overall consumer price inflation that has hit 7% in March. The Bank of England says rising food prices are a major concern. The U.S. Congresswoman is putting forth a resolution to the House of Representatives for the recognition of the well-documented Palestinian Nakba. Rashida Tlaib, who's of Palestinian descent, tweeted that the Nakba continues to happen today. Just days ago, Palestinians marked the 74th anniversary of the Nakba, or the day of the catastrophe. The occasion marks the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes by Israel in 1948. Since then, millions of Palestinians have been living in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, and in neighboring countries. Tlaib says when people refuse to acknowledge the Israeli war crimes, Palestinians are denied their humanity. Several Palestinian rights groups have praised the move against Israel, which has enjoyed widespread support from Washington for decades. A heavy dust storm has forced the closure of schools, universities, and public offices across several Iranian provinces, including the capital, Tehran. The dust storm, originating from Iraq and Syria, entered Iran on Monday, blanketing eight provinces, mostly in the west. The concentration of fine dust particles in some cities is 20 times higher than safety levels. In neighboring Iraq, officials say that at least 4,000 people have swarmed hospitals with breathing problems. This is the eighth sandstorm to hit Iraq over the past month. A thick cloud of dust has enveloped the capital, Baghdad, in an orange glow, prompting the city's authorities to declare a day off for local government institutions. Baghdad International Airport has halted all flights and closed its airspace until further notice. According to the UN, Iraq is the fifth most vulnerable country to climate crisis. The Japanese island of Okinawa has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japan amid protests against the continued heavy American military presence and the lack of support from the mainland.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
Hundreds of protesters staged a rally in Okinawa demanding a reduction of American military forces. Meanwhile, fears in Japan that China could enter a war with the U.S. over Taiwan have risen since Russia attacked Ukraine. There's a growing fear that the island chain may become a front line of conflict.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the U.S. and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views U.S. military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The U.S. is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil, missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
the United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it.
And that does it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Each Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition because, for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Doctor, actually, on this point, if I may, with your permission, it's very interesting because you mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski. He actually states very clearly in his book, this was written in the late 20th century, he says that the worst scenario for America, he clearly states this, the worst scenario for America is an alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. So this is not some like when you are mentioning these things, when we in Iran talk about these things, these are not some sort of, you know, guesses. These are not some sort of conspiracy theories. These are things that are stated very clearly and openly by the leadership and by the elites in America. And so this is in terms of just, you know, complementing what you're saying, that, you know, it's clearly stated just as... It's very interesting for me because the things you mentioned, my specialty is strategic studies, international relations. Many of the things that you're mentioning are said, we talk about these things in strategic studies, in international relations, of course, in our own language, in our own jargon that we have. So, for example, you mentioned the British and their whole desire since the 19th century to destroy the Russian Empire. Well, again, this is clearly stated by Halford Mackinder, who is considered the father, or so-called the founding father of modern geopolitics and geostrategic studies. Of course, he was a geographer who for the first time looked at the world as one geostrategic unit and talked about the fact that whoever wants to rule the world has to control, of course, he used his own language, but what we would call today Eurasia, that if Eurasia on its own is so big and powerful and capable of... And if we look at historically, and, you know, I think there were economists in Holland that did a long-term study about this, which is that if you look at the global history, 80 to 90% of global history has been dominated in terms of the economic production and the center of civilization being in Eurasia, being in Asia. So this idea that somehow the North Atlantic or the Americans would dominate the world is actually a very strange and unusual situation that we had in human history. It's coming back to this situation where it was for centuries and for millennia. But you see people like Halford Mackinder
clearly stating that their goal is to prevent any Eurasian power coming becoming powerful and being a rival. And at that time, this is all in emphasizing the points you were making from a strategic studies perspective, that very clearly Halford Mackinder stating that the goal has to be that in no way, shape, or form should Russia and Germany be allied and be united, and that there has to always be a buffer zone between Germany and Russia where they can exploit these petty nationalisms, where these countries can either be used against Germany or can be used against Russia anytime there's a danger that you would see Russia or Germany becoming powerful and then uniting in terms of strategically and economically, as you were mentioning, as was already happening in the end of the 19th century. The other thing that was very interesting for me, Doctor, was that actually there is serious people who would argue that the Americans, in a way, actually also had a Ministry of Industry that was controlling its industrial growth after World War II. It was just called the Pentagon. It wasn't called the Ministry of Industry. It was called the Ministry of Defense. So in a way, yes, they had those corporations that were, on paper, they were private. And they were, of course, private. The profits went to the oligarchs. It created an oligarchy in the United States. But its strategic coordination was done at the Pentagon. So things like the internet, things like mobile technology, mobile phones, all those technologies that we saw, you know, emerging out of the 20th century, if you trace a lot of them back, you see even things like civilian aircraft, civilian passenger flight. A lot of these things that were technologies that transformed the world technologically, if you trace back the money, you see that at some point they went back to the Pentagon and programs that were financed. And the reason is this, Doctor, and I'm so happy we're able to talk about these things on television, which is that very rarely do you have private investors willing to invest large sums of money for something that will be profitable in 10 or 20 years. This is just not something that a private investor will do. The horizon for profitability is maximum 4 to 5 years. And this is why, in reference to the new model that you are referring to in terms of the model that is being used in China or India, but also to a certain extent in Iran, which I will talk about a little bit with your permission. So what we need is, and this is exactly actually what happened in the US as well, which is that private companies were not willing to invest into technologies such as civilian airliners, such as those other advanced technologies, because it would have taken them 10, 15 years to get the profits. So the government comes in, gives them something called a government contract. This allows them to have profits and then take those profits for themselves or invest it into other areas. I think in Iran, we had a very similar experience as you were describing with China and India. Of course, I think, this is my personal view, is that the places where we made a mistake is where we sort of blindly imitated some of those bad habits that we see in the West in terms of financialing, making the economy more financial-based, not having those controls that they have in India and in China. So all this, what I want to sum up with is that a lot of the things that you are mentioning, which is very interesting, is exactly also things that in strategic studies and international relations we also talk about, of course, in our own language. And what we say in international relations or in strategic studies is that when those realities on the ground, those technologies, those real indicators of power and wealth, when they shift and the political institutions do not shift, that's when the conflict happens. So you have a reality in the world where the Americans bankrupted themselves pretty much by 2008, if you look at the financial crisis that happened in the United States. You had the so-called war on terror. I would just suggest this to you, Doctor, that actually the hybrid war, as far as the Iranians are concerned, has been going on since the 1990s. We've been experiencing all those elements that you describe as a hybrid war in Iran since the 1990s. Of course, because the scale of the conflict was smaller, Maybe a lot of people in the world didn't realize this. Of course, those who were experts understood what the Americans were doing in Iran and in trying to fight Iran. All those elements that are now being used in this hybrid war against Russia and China were first used, tested, tried with Iran. And I think the interesting thing for maybe Russia and China is to look and to see how was Iran capable of resisting and not succumbing to this hybrid war. A lot of it, which of course you also indicated, which is to have that strategic management being centralized, but also taking advantage of market mechanisms and allowing both the forces that are social, but also the forces that are related to the central government being able to coordinate the different interests that exist. So with that in mind, I apologize. I just felt that there was it was very interesting to me. I wanted to add and emphasize some of the points you were saying from our perspective as strategic studies or international relations. So with that in mind, Dr. Ghazayev, what does the future look like? What is it, how is it that we're going to now move away from this system dominated by what is becoming an inefficient American system, a system that is abusing that system of banking and money, which was serving it for a purpose for a period of time, and weaponizing it and using it as a political tool and weapon against different countries. One thing that maybe we could talk about is the idea that, for example, why is it that we denominate all major important commodities in the dollar? I mean, Iran has a lot of oil and gas. Russia has a lot of oil and gas. Why do we have to sell it in dollars to India and China? We are neighbors. We're on the same continent. How is it that things like dollar hegemony and those other things that are the markers of the current system, what is the future going to look like? How can we replace these things that are currently existing with new systems, and what are those new systems going to be? And if you could please, we don't have a lot more time left, just if you could give us the gist of it.
To be brief, according to the long-term economic growth theory, it is quite clear that America is going to lose. It is no doubt that America will lose its leadership as well the British Empire lost it a century ago. Not because we don't like America, it's because America has obsolete and, in fact, inefficient economic system. They use their financial opportunities. They still have hegemony in the world of finance. Still, American dollar dominates in all transactions, which you mentioned, in the currency reserves. But it is very important that America lost its privilege to print the world money about 1 month ago. Of course, you're right that Iran is suffering from this hybrid war about 30 years. And of course, we had to look for the Iranian experience. Unfortunately, the Russian financial elite was very confident in the American state, in American policy, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy becomes, in fact, the peripheral economy. It was used by the Americans as a donor, and by the Europeans. Yes. We exported raw materials, and we had capital flight about $100 billion per year. And the Russian economy was too much dependent from the American influence, especially the governance of the Russian central banks was controlled by the IMF, and IMF recommendations were implemented in Russia with catastrophic results. But America was too much, it was too much concentrated on Russophobia. Mm-hmm. And it played a bad joke with the Americans. They used their main weapon, the dominance in the world financial system against Russia, and they do not have any cards more. The American dollar is not considered as a reserve currency anymore in Asia. Of course, you have such experience before. For you, dollar is not reserve currency for a long time. But for Russia, and now for China as well. America, and for India, I am sure. American dollar lost its image as a world currency, and America so lost its main main weapon, I should say. In this book, which I showed to you, I made some recommendations. They were written about, as I mentioned, 6 years ago. And the first recommendations was to, if you want to finish this war, if you want to save the mankind from the American aggression, we have to create coalition between those countries who are not interested in the war, who want peaceful development, and who are constructing now the new world economic mode. So we have to avoid to get rid from dollar. Get rid from dollar as a world currency in trade, in reserves, in financial transactions. For Russia and for Iran, it is no question anymore. It is no question also, I think, for China. And American superpower is undermined now because the world do not believe in American dollar anymore. And we have to move as far as possible for the national currencies in our relations. And now in our economic commission, we are trying to elaborate with our the Russian academician experts, trying to elaborate the model for the new world currency. Mm-hmm. It should be based on the commodity basket. As you mentioned, Russia and Iran have dominance in the oil sector.
Exactly.
We also have dominance together in the metallurgy, in the chemical sector, in water, in coal, in a lot of commodities. We can organize the common economic space, which will be independent from the Western benchmarks. What we are thinking about to create the Asian exchange, mm-hmm. which will generate its own prices. Prices should for all those commodities should not be generated in London or in New York. These are our commodities, and we can organize our economic space in such a way that the price formation for those commodities will satisfy our needs, not needs of the Western speculations, but the needs of the production sector.
Doctor, if I excuse me, so if I understand you correctly, we are looking maybe at a special international currency, not a national currency, but one that is backed by the national currencies and the commodities, and that so
yes.
is this correct? Did I understand this correctly? That yes, this would
the
then
idea,
be. Go ahead, please.
The idea is to create the new world currency, which could be used for the trans-border transactions. This currency should be constructed on the basis of the basket of the national currencies mm-hmm. of those countries which are involved in this process, like a special development, special deposit rights of the IMF.
Yes.
But on the basis of the another principles, more fair and more clear. And another part of this currency should be the basket of commodities. If you combine together the basket of national currencies and basket of commodities and create the synthetic currency based on this about 30 subjects in the basket, we can go we can create a very a strong currency which will be very stable in spite of all the international conjuncture.
So, excuse me, Doctor, so let me understand you correctly. So this currency is not a currency that we in different countries would be having in our wallets, in our bank accounts. We would still be using our national accounts. This would be a purely international currency used by for the transaction between countries for the sale of the commodities that exist, that it would
be
backed by the power of the national currencies and by the commodities that are so abundant in Asia. Which is interesting because you talked about fiat money, it's actually very, very new that we have fiat money. For throughout human history, we actually had commodity-backed money. We had money that there was something that people could back it with. So this is going back to that, in a certain way, going back to that.
Yes, but you are quite right. In international transactions, if you are speaking about the national economies, each country has its own national currency.
Very good.
Fiat currency, which can be used for monetary support of the investment activity. But the currency which I'm talking about is the currency for international transactions. Of course, we need some kind of organization like that. For instance, in BRICS, we have the basket of the reserve currencies of BRICS. We can involve BRICS countries as well, not only Asian countries, but let's take also Brazil and South Africa, use the BRICS organization. So the idea is to get rid from any kind of private monopoly on the world money. The new world money should be created on the basis of international treaty. This is the first foundation of the new economic world economic structure. The second foundation is the information technologies. As you know, the American Agency of National Security is the cyber terrorist number one in the world. Mm-hmm. Almost about half of cyber attacks are coming from the United States, from the one place, Agency of National Security. The United States is the only country which don't want to sign the International Treaty for Cybersecurity. So our peace coalition should also has another, not only monetary treaty, but also a treaty on information technologies, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism. And those countries, like the United States, who doesn't want to sign this agreement and to fulfill this agreement, should be under our sanctions. So we shouldn't use information technologies which are developed by the countries who sponsor the cyber terrorism, like the United States and Great Britain. This is the second foundation. And the third foundation, which becomes also very actual. As you know, the Americans is the only country in the world which openly violates the International Convention Against the Biological Weapons. As we have seen in Ukraine, the Americans were conducting the elaboration of the biological weapons using the Ukrainian population. So the COVID pandemic is also part of this biological war. So our coalition of the countries which want to finish this hybrid war and to create opportunities for the peaceful, sustainable economic growth, to my mind, should have three basic foundations. The first one is the Treaty Convention on the Issuing of the World Money, which I described. The second one, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism, which will regulate the use of information technologies in the world. And the third one, the Convention on the Control over the Fulfillment of the Convention on Biological Security. These are three foundations will be enough to create a very powerful worldwide coalition against American aggression. And I think here in Asia, we can be able to create new architecture, financial architecture, trade architecture of economic relations, which will be based on the mutual interests, which will be based on the international law, and which will be quite different from the liberal globalization led by Washington, because each country has its sovereign rights to elaborate those type of regulation of economy which is adequate to its cultural heritage, to the people's norms of behavior, and the diversity of the economic national systems is also the part of this new world economic mode. The main idea of international relations should be creation opportunities for the growth of investments, not trade liberalization, not currency liberalization, but creation of more opportunities for economic growth, for the growth of the well-being of societies. for the growth of the real incomes of the population. So I think together we can organize such kind of new economic mode, which will be attractive for the whole world.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately. It was very interesting talking to you. And on that positive note, thank you so much. And hopefully, if there's opportunity arises, we can continue this discussion at a later time. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Glazev? If we look at the issue from the perspective of long-term economic cycles analysis, the era of U.S. economic power is coming to an end, and a new era of economic power based in Asia, particularly in China and India, is beginning because of more efficient production models that have been established there in recent years, combining centralized strategic planning with market forces and the channeling of profits into production as opposed to channeling them into the personal wealth of a few wealthy oligarchs. In contrast, the U.S. has shifted from a production-based economy to a financially dominated economy, characterized by extreme wealth gaps and the channeling of profits into the hands of a few oligarchs and into offshore tax havens, instead of into the expansion of production and jobs, an issue central to the Trump and America First campaign and presidency, and one of the keys to understanding the current social and political conflict that exists domestically in the U.S. We can add to this America's endless global war against terror that has been going on for more than 20 years and which has morally and infrastructurally bankrupted the U.S. with trillions of dollars spent on foreign wars, while basic needs and infrastructure are at a third world level in many parts of the United States. We can further add to this the fact that the Western-dominated global financial and banking systems are losing credibility because of their weaponization by the U.S. to wage economic war against its global rivals and enemies, thus accelerating the emergence of a new non-Western global financial and banking system that allows countries to engage in trade and commerce outside of U.S. dollar hegemony. The geostrategic alignment of China, Russia, and Iran, which the late American geostrategist Zbigniew Brzezinski called America's worst-case scenario, has also entered into the express lane, particularly after the severe sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its European vassals on Russia following the Ukrainian war, which have effectively cut Russia off from the West and have accelerated Russia's strategic reorientation towards Asia and the global South. All this sets the stage for a fundamental change in the global order and very interesting and eventful times in the years and decades to come. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a shorter speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
When you want to enter the holy shrine of an infallible, or at the time they were alive to enter their houses, you have to have permission. Permission was either an invitation by the infallible himself, or is a type of supplication at the entrance of their holy graves. Of course, someone can enter the holy shrine of an infallible without permission. However, the quality of his or her ziyarah or homage may not be considered high.
مرحوم علامه مجلسی مثلا تو بهار داره یکی از شرایط ظاهریش این هستش که دلت بشکنه.
The late Allama Majlisi in his book Bihar al-Anwar refers to some of the requirements for entering the holy shrines. Having a soft heart and shedding tears are two of such important requirements. This is why when the great people of God wanted to enter a holy shrine, they would supplicate or recite a dua to prepare their heart and soul to start their visitation to the shrine of an infallible. All this means that entering a shrine or graveside of an infallible has its own formal etiquettes, and in this way, one can benefit better from his presence in a holy site. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.